It's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock. To be a part of the show, call 1-800-313-9443.
Believe me when I say we have a difficult time ahead of us. But if we are to be prepared for it, we must first shed our fear of it. I stand here without fear because I remember. I remember that I am here not because of the path that lies before me, but because of the path that lies behind me. I remember that for 100 years we have fought these machines. And after a century of war, I remember that which matters most. We are still here! Tonight, let us make them remember. We are not afraid!
Yeah, 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 we're not afraid here on Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, because we're going to know what's happening. H.L. Quist is here helping us understand what is going to happen so that we can prepare. As bad as things, I tell you what fear is. Fear is not knowing, being startled, surprised, kind of, you know, you don't know, you can't even make a decision. All you do is react emotionally. I'm going to do whatever Obama tells me because I'm afraid. Well, what happens if you really know what's going on? Then you get busy. To get busy, you go buy some chickens. Okay, so now we're. I want to get to the even in this short segment here. For you got a couple minutes, and I want to make sure that we talk about one thing here. We knew, looking at the multiple listing service, that there was an enormous glut. There was 40% of the houses up for sale a couple of years ago were vacant. Vacant. They were being speculated on by Lord knows who, saying, oh, Las Vegas, Phoenix, man, we need to buy us some houses because they're cheaper than the ones we got in Southern California. They sell there, buy a whole bunch here because people were giving them free money and whatever, and the Fed and the bubble being pushed, and go buy. So they did. Well, now we're in a situation where, man, there is a glut, and we got a bigger glut. There are banks that are sitting there. They make my son-in-law, daughter-in-law are making all these offers on these houses, and I go, I'll bet you there's no way they're going to be liquidating these. And if they do, they'll wait till July in the new fiscal year or something, because then they're going to have to mark the market their entire portfolio and they'll go bankrupt. So I'm going, you know what? And we don't even have the resetting of the adjustable rate mortgages coming that it's going to be peaking heck now or, you know, this next quarter. And I'm going, there is an enormous supply. We're going to get down to this supply demand thing, and there is going to be a crash in real estate prices again. In my opinion, what's yours?
There's you're painting the picture correctly, and you know, this is the disinflation coming on top of a market that's already in deep trouble. What I see happening, Ernest, which is going to everything's a temporary fix that Congress and the politicians and Wall Street come up with. Nothing that's long term or a permanent fix. What's coming, in my opinion, is devaluation of the dollar, a deliberate devaluation of the dollar to try, a lot of it's politically motivated with the midterm elections coming up, but is try to save the real estate business, try to prevent the disinflation, undercapitalizing all these loans and putting all these loans in negative territory. You know, that's a last-ditch desperation move, but I'll remind our audience that the Plaza Accord occurred in 1985 to devalue the U.S. dollar because it was too strong in relation to other world currencies. And we had a boom in real estate, stocks, gold, everything for a short period of time until they had another meeting at the Louvre in Paris and decided to strengthen the dollar. And, of course, that's when we had the 87 crash. But I see that coming. And, you know, people have to understand that debt is a constant. And if they devalue the dollar, there's an offsetting increase in the fixed assets of real estate, commodities, gold, everything.
Okay, so now that's what
I see that. I see that coming.
Okay, now this is what we're going to, you know, we'll pick it up when we come back right there, what happened in 85. And, you know, we need to have a complete understanding of what happened then because, you know, this thing just keep, it's cyclical. They just keep doing what they think they know what to do. And do they really know what's going on? We'll find out. You stay right there.
It's time to declare your independence with Ernest Hancock. To be a part of the show, call 1-800-313-9443. And now, live from the studios of Freedom's Phoenix, Ernest Hancock.
Welcome, 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 welcome back to Declare Your Independence. Me, Ernest Hancock, and H.L. Quist, forecaster. He is author and historical economist that has all the information that we want to pick his brain. And you, man, you, declare your independence with information. You know how you declare your independence? Let me tell you how to do it. It's really easy. Here we go. I declare my independence. See how easy that was? And you don't even need a government form. I mean, woo, man, don't get me going. I'm in the mood today. A little bit too much coffee. Okay, now this is what I want to do, HL. Let's go back. See, you know, you're a historical economist. Let's go back in the mid-80s. Now, I graduated in 79. I remember, you know, all this. It was like the headlines from today. You just take them from, you know, late 70s, early 80s. Same, same, same. Iran, oil, lines, war, Afghanistan, you know, hyperinflation, interest rates. I mean, my kids always go, I have four children, two boys, two girls, 20 to 24, and they go, Dad, you don't understand. Are you kidding me? Let's go look at the headlines from. I go, you get it? I went through this before, and they keep doing it until they're not going to be able to do it anymore. Now, what happened in the exporting of all kinds of manufacturing, it was not prudent to do business in this country, starting certainly after we went off the gold standard. I'm sure that started a lot of this. So here we go. It's the mid-80s, and they had a meeting to strengthen or not strengthen the dollar and so on. Why did they do that, and what was the impact?
Well, it was Paul Volcker was the Fed chairman, and he was the epitome of the inflation fighter. He was going to slay the inflation dragon, you know, and of course, he did that with tight money and higher interest rates. And even in 82, 83, remember Reagan came into office. Reagan had a real tough time. 82, I mean, supply-side economics, and nobody was buying it, and they wanted to reduce taxes and all that. And the economy was really in a difficult time because of the high interest rates. And one of the things is that the dollar was so strong because people were buying U.S. dollars because the yield was so high, you know, U.S. treasuries and so forth. And interest rates started dropping, but the economy wasn't going anywhere. The Plaza Accord was designed to lower the value of the dollar in relationship to other currencies around the world. I was in the real estate development business then, and we were having trouble finding money to develop this land in Scottsdale and so forth. And they passed this Plaza Accord, which was an agreement of all the G7 countries at that time to lower the value of the dollar deliberately. And,
How do you do that?
They do it through concerted action. In other words, the central banks in these G7 countries, they can buy or sell dollars to either strengthen it or to weaken it. And, of course, the whole game plan there was to sell U.S. dollars, which weakened the dollar. In other words, lower demand means lower value of
the
dollar.
Okay.
And it was almost instant, Ernest. We were sitting there wondering how we were going to get the money to develop all this property and so forth. And the bankers that had turned us down were calling on us. You know, that loan that you guys had submitted here a year or so ago, do you still need the money? And suddenly we had three banks coming in, and that really took off. I mean, it was an unbelievable time. You had Michael Milken with the junk bonds, and you had the real estate deals that were being made for all the tax considerations and everything. It was a wild period, which, of course, led to the bust, the stock market bust in 87, and then, of course, the real estate collapse in 1989.
SNL scandal. I remember all
period,
the SNL scandal. I mean, the SNL thing. I mean, this is what, you know, they change regulations, too. They go like this. They said, you know, even to add insult to Andrew, what we're going to do is we're going to deregulate and let you guys spend the money any way you want, which is fine by me. But at the same time, we're going to insure the deposits, and you get to do whatever you want, and we'll insure it anyway. And then the savings and loan thing.
Well, the Garn-St. Germain Act of 1981 allowed savings and loans to take direct participation in real estate. So you had all of these things that were going by 85 and 86, that whole real estate and the commodity business, everything was getting out of control. And, of course, that's when they had the Louvre Accord, which was to increase the value of the dollar again. But here was a concerted effort by the central banks around the world to bail the U.S. out of a particular problem it had at that particular time.
You know, it's all this Keynesian thought that, you know, the economy is a bunch of dials. And whenever I get a number on in the lamestream media, the media that's so last century, when they come out with a number, I can already tell. I know what's going to happen. We got a program, a law, a policy that's going to change that number. We're going to turn a dial. Yeah, this is too high. We're going to turn this dial, make it lower. And it has nothing to do with the fundamentals underneath it, which will always rear its head. So now we're in the late 80s. They've, you know, increased the money supply, you know, well, at least access to money by selling them into the market. It's cheap. And here, you know, we want to fund your thing. And then they change their mind midstream, say, no. We changed our mind. Now there is no more money. I mean, what happened then?
Well, see, we don't have a free market anymore. It's so manipulated, and they've created so many imbalances in the world. That's why everything that we're doing now is unsustainable. If our listeners this morning will just think in terms of that, the whole trend, this whole debt cycle, is unsustainable globally, and that's why it's going to end. It's going to end in a massive deflation or in hyperinflation as it did in Germany during the 20s and Argentina as late as 2001. Just massive hyperinflation.
Okay, let's go back to where you were doing your development in Scottsdale. The banks come to you. Now all this money is available. They want to give. Did you take?
Right. We borrowed a substantial amount, yes.
Okay, so you go ahead and you build your project, and then
how
did that come
out? We were smart enough to recognize that this bubble was going to end, because it was a commercial real estate bubble in the 80s. And we sold the project. We put it all together, put all the land, got all the entitlements, everything, right in the heart of Scottsdale. You'd know exactly where it was, Lincoln and Scottsdale Road. And we sold that package to a builder to do a hotel, huge Ritz-Carlton hotel, golf course, and 200 single-family residences. And so we saw that happening. We saw the bubble bursting at the end of 88. We sold it.
And when was Black Monday? That was October.
Was October of 87.
And you still made out. You the man.
Well, see, that was a stock market crash, but that told us that something was wrong. Something was wrong in the system, and we were motivated to sell it. We sold it on pretty soft terms. And what happened by 89 is that the FIREA, was the Financial Reform Act, was instituted by Congress to shut off all real estate financing because the bubble had gotten out of control. And our buyer couldn't finance the project, and so he defaulted on all the debt that he had with us. So it was good news we sold it. It was bad news that he could not finance it, and, of course, he defaulted on all the money he owed us.
Wow. And these kinds of, and this is the point that I'm making, we go through the history on this, is that in a free market, the market determines the value
right.
of the money. You know, capitalism, I mean, in its, you know, original definition is, you know, I save money, I put it out, I loan it out to people, I make the money back. It's, you know, I got it, you need it, you pay me, you know, it's all good. And they keep changing the rules. They keep changing the supply. They keep changing the access. They keep changing to the point that the monetary system that we have now, based on all this pretend paper of everything, is that finally, sooner or later, you know, just math comes into play and people start to realize, you know what? I need something like, gold. And it becomes what it always was, which is just a store of value. People, you know, you think that you're making a gazillion dollars when your gold went to $5,000 an ounce, and all it really means is that the dollar devalued.
We're in a debt spiral. That's the bottom line, that we've accumulated all this debt over the years, and as Felix Zuloff, who's in Switzerland, is a really brainy guy, says what's going to happen is all this debt has to be just washed away. It just and it can't be absorbed in the system because there's so much debt. You know, in the past, you'd go through a bubble bursting and so forth, and the whole economy would absorb X amount of debt that couldn't be paid.
But because there was debt
in now where you can't refinance anything anymore to the extent that's necessary.
Because there's nothing to refinance. It used to be if you had a debt, it was on your boat. I mean, it was on your house. It was on your land. It was on something. Now the debt is on hundreds of trillions of dollars of paper called derivatives. When we come back, we'll talk about that because, you're right. It's got to all get all washed away. And who's left holding back? Who bought the derivatives? Your pension plan, it's not there anymore. Well, we'll ask Mr. Quist about it when we come back. We'll be right back here on Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, and my guest, H.L. Quist, in just a little bit.
There are those that just want to be left alone, and those that just won't leave them alone. Which one are you? The Ernest Hancock Show.
Change. New days are strange. Is the world insane? If love and peace is so strong, why are the pieces of love that don't belong? Nations dropping bombs, chemical gases filling lungs of little ones with ongoing suffering as the youth are young. So ask yourself, is the loving really gone? So I could ask myself, really what is going wrong in this world that we living in? People keep on giving in, making wrong decisions, only visions of the negative. Not respecting each other, denying thy brother. A war's going on, but the reason's undercover. The truth is kept secret, it's swept under the rug. If you never know truth, then you never know love. What's the love, y'all? Come on.
I don't know.
What's the truth, y'all? Come on.
I don't know.
What's the love, y'all?
Yeah, where's the truth, dog? You know, you're not going to have love if you don't have truth. And we're going to try and give you some truth here and declare your independence with a special guest like H.L. Quist. Now, the one thing that I did want to get into is debt derivatives. We want to talk about this derivative thing a little bit. Now, we're going to need to get you your writings and stuff. You participate on Freedom's Phoenix because we got a lot of great economists on there. Of course, we always have Dr. Paul stuff up on there and Peter Schiff and one of our columnists is Bill Bonner. Today he has an article on there. Doug Casey, Casey Research is always putting stuff up on Freedom's Phoenix. So you're in good company, man. We want to make sure we get some Quist up there. But I'm telling you, there's one thing that Bill Bonner, we had him on the radio and so on Charles Goyette's show. I used to produce for Charles, and that's the intro, coming back. That's Charles's voice. So we've been following this from the beginning. And he wrote the book, The Dollar Meltdown, and I remember all of the stuff in that book. We were studying this. We knew it was coming. And Bonner came out, him and Addison Wiggins, they did the Empire of Debt, and they were going, look,
right,
this derivative thing, it's in the tens of trillions, hundreds of trillions of dollars back then. And now, I mean, heck, if we go back just to, Bloomberg was reporting back in 2007 that it's like 500 and something trillion dollars. Heck, it may be double that. You know, it's like, you know, we have a sign that we're doing that has this baby and has a little bubble out there and it says, Mommy, what's a quadrillion? this is coming. You're talking real money here. So now we're in a situation to where I want people, the audience, to understand the entire global domestic product. I mean, the entire world economy is valued at, I don't know what, 60, 70 trillion dollars or something. We got 10 times that in just paper. How did this happen? What is it? And then, like you're saying, you know, you're just going to have to hit the reset button. Well, who gets screwed on that?
Well, there's several things that happened that the masters of the universe orchestrated this beautifully, starting with Greenspan when he came into the Federal Reserve in 1987. You know, by repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act, that allowed the banks to go into trading derivatives again and creating all kinds of leverage. And it was Hank Paulson, when he was at Goldman Sachs, he went to the SEC and got them to increase the leverage of the banks from 10 to 1 to 40 to 1. So a combination of all these things and the legislation that went on with Congress and lobbying the SEC and all that, they created an environment where they could just speculate with paper and created, I guess at its peak, it reached somewhere around $650 trillion in what they call the nominal value or notional value of these derivatives. But you know, the thing that's amazing about this, Ernest, is that after we've gotten through this whole thing about the subprime, which was a big part of this, the derivatives, is that the number is still $600 trillion. In other words, there hasn't been a reduction in the total amount at risk. It stayed about the same. So that's what's amazing to me. You think that these derivatives would be unwound, that these contracts would have been canceled, that they would have been, you know, paid off. I mean, the AIG, of course, had just enormous amounts of derivatives at risk.
Yeah, well,
the number's still the same.
Well,
the number's still the same.
No, this is what, you know, correct me if I'm wrong here. Here's AIG selling these derivatives. You know, we got a short segment here. We'll get into this in the next segment. But, you know, they got these derivatives out there. Well, who was owed them? You know, Goldman Sachs, as you say. Okay, so what do? They go to Congress and say, "Man, you got to bail out AIG so we can get our money." I mean, that's what happened.
Yeah, Goldman was covering they were covering their butt by selling insurance to guarantee those contracts, and AIG was doing all the buying.
Oh, you said a naughty word.
That's how Goldman Sachs protected themselves, is that they had them insured with AIG, and then of course AIG got in big trouble, and here comes Paulson and TARP guaranteed and putting all this money into AIG, $185 billion. Who's the first people they paid off?
Goldman. So yeah, I mean the thing.
Goldman. They paid off the insurance contracts that AIG had guaranteed to Goldman.
Okay, this is a naughty word that you said. You said insurance. You said insurance. See, I talk about, you know, derivatives being kind of this insurance policy. They freak out. Everybody, no matter when, you know, years ago as we're covering this, they're going, "It's not insurance." I'm like, "Well, what the heck is it?" And they're going, "Because insurance, using that word, you know, puts you in this regulatory kind of, you need to have assets back in kind of." And they go, "Oh, heck no, even though it worked the same." We'll explain that when we come back. But, you know, this is, it's easier to understand what a derivative is if you understand how it was used. It was like writing 20 policies on an AIDS patient in his last few days in a hospital bed and sitting around waiting for him to die so you could collect. I mean, you know, how close is that? I mean, you know, we're going to get to that when we come back here on Declare Your Independence with H.L. Quist.
It's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock. To be a part of the show, call 1-800-313-9443.
And he decides who to free and who to blame. Everybody won't be treated all the same. There'll be a golden ladder reaching down when the man comes around.
Oh, and the man be a-coming. Yeah, you get ready for the man. He's going to want more of your goodies. I'm guarantee you that. And because they can. Okay, that's, you know, you want to know the reason why they do all this stuff and how, and they're taking it. How can they? The Constitution says, and they're not supposed to, and they had a law, and it used to be, and they said, and I'm going, yeah, well, who's got the shiny badge and the gun? Okay, well, that's why, because they can't. Well, I got my special guest on, H.L. Quist, on. He's a historical economist in real estate. He's done development. I mean, you know, he pays attention. And the boy's got, you know, good friends. He's one of us. He's a revolutionary. Now, the thing that
I've been there and done that.
Been there, done that. Got burned.
I've been there.
Now, one thing I wanted to get into this derivative thing, and I'll tell you the conversations that we've had. As soon as we started to understand derivatives, and then we'll get to International Bank of Settlements, too. I want to make a note of that. Bank of Settlements, because I got some things on that. But on derivatives, I started to understand what I was trying to wrap my mind. In fact, we did studies on it here. We went down to the county recorder's office. We had friends at investment properties. We get, you know, who's listed on the document. And it's just like what do they call it? Recording service, you know, that the banks created that so they could chop everything up in these mortgage-backed securities and who do you owe and who can foreclose and how. And we're going, going, whoa. And here at the workshop of Freedom's Phoenix, every weekend on Saturdays and Sundays, they have between 100 and 300 people show up to get classes on their mortgage and how they can fight it and what they're going to do and the filings it can do and who do they owe and so on. Another guy, I let him just use this, and it started off at like 20, 30 people. I come in on the weekend, you know, there's cars everywhere. This is enormous what's happening.
Yeah.
Now, and I'm going, okay, so I have the guys come in, let's talk about it and get in this, what we've kind of got out of this thing. The banks, it was so easy. If you could fog a mirror, you could get a loan because they didn't care about you ever paying it back. They didn't care because they made their money on taking that mortgage and turning it into paper that then they do this mortgage-backed security and they're selling the paper, which was really kind of – it evolves into a derivative. A derivative – is just derived from an index. You know, all these other the derivatives they have, all these paper where they can't be of any value if nobody buys them. And the only way somebody can buy them is if I'm a pension fund. I'm sitting here, the California Pension Fund of Workers, De La, whatever, and I got $1 billion in this nice little bucket that somebody wants the money. And they go, you know what? We're gonna have you buy this mortgage-backed security. And then we're going to take half that money and put it in our pockets and say thank you very much. And then we're going to pay you. You get access to the revenue stream. You don't really own the property. You just get like a pinky swear promise that the revenue is going to you, even though we know they're not going to be able to pay it as time goes on. But that's not our concern. We already made our money. Okay, so they go ahead and they put this paper out there, and then all of a sudden they don't start making it. The pension fund goes, hey, man, we want our money. You know, how do we – well, you don't have access really to the property. You don't get the anything. You were just – you had the revenue stream. It stopped. You don't get it anymore. You don't get your promised 6% or 10% or whatever heck it was. So that's how their money became somebody else's money in one way. The other way is that you got these derivatives based that are just indexes. It goes, okay, this value of this paper is – due to whatever we say the temperature of the weather is going to be out here or something. It's derived from it. It's gambling. It's just we're betting on whatever. But what happens is that it doesn't have any underlying anything. To get them to buy those, they have to – somebody has to give it a AAA rating. Here comes Moody's and S&P. So we got Moody. My brother-in-law is one of the bond raters at Moody's. So you can imagine conversations we have, okay?
Yep.
So I'm going, how did you base – what is kind of – you know, and he goes in off in his gobbledygook Keynesian stuff and so on. Doesn't make any difference. And now he just dodged a bullet here a couple of days ago when Congress is going to start, we're going to put them out of business. So they paid off, you know, somebody, I don't know, whatever. So, you know, they're going to be okay for another week or two. So I'm going, all right. So we have these derivatives that the best way to explain them is that it was an insurance policy. If this index of subprime loans or whatever, you're betting on the market as a whole, and you go, I think that it's going to go down. Well, I'm going to invest in your mortgage-backed security thing over here, and it's triple A, and that's the only way that the law in that state or something will allow me to buy it is if it's triple A. Who's going to give me a triple A? Moody's, triple A. They go, okay, cool. Now I can buy it. So then they buy it, and then we're going to hedge ourselves, and we're going to buy this insurance policy. If the market goes down, well, then it's going to pay off. And we'll pay, you know, I don't know, $5, $10 million for a $100 million package. Well, okay, if it goes down, then I make my $100 million. Well, then for some reason, somehow, they were able to sell that policy to someone else where they can become the beneficiary. And this is where Peter Schiff came in. Peter Schiff, you know, he sees this, he goes to his buddies, and we're going to get up on the market, you know, in options or whatever. We're going to go ahead and pay. We'll pay you $10 million for your $5 million cost that you got to get $100 million because we know the $100 million's coming. So we pay $10 million. We sit on it. They sell it at $50, $60 million or whatever because people are going, hey, man, it's going to go. Well, that's going to be worth $100 million. Well, what did Peter know? They're not going to be able to afford to pay it. There's not enough money to do it. It's hundreds of trillions of dollars in these pieces of paper of promises we're going to pay something, and there isn't enough money in existence to pay it off. So they go ahead and sell it, make their money. Thank you very much. Somebody gets stuck with this insurance policy and nobody to pay it off. How far off am I?
Well, I think that you've got a good, you've painted a good scenario on what happened. In addition to that, I took this from Michael Lewis's The Big Short, which is a fabulous book to read, is that Goldman and J.P. Morgan were controlling the value of these derivatives, these contracts, and they're setting a market value. You know, we talked on Tuesday when your wife was in the class about conflict of interest. Well, they were setting the price of these index, and they were already knew that the market was going to crater, but they were holding up the value while they were selling tranches of this debt short, so that they were covered on the short side as well as being insured by AIG. So they covered their butts, you know, but they were holding the market up, which was a massive conflict of interest, which most people are not aware of. It's a very complex picture, but what I call it, Ernest, is an inverted pyramid. In the bottom of the pyramid, you got an upside down pyramid. You got $1, and at the top of it, you've got somewhere between $50, $100, $200 of risk of paper. So you've got $1 of equity, and you've got all this paper. And of course, what we saw was that it started collapsing. As Michael points out in his book, is that in the triple B tranches of debt that, you know, they sold the income stream, like you say, and so forth, is that when the default rate exceeded 8%, the entire portfolio, it could be $100 million, the entire portfolio was worthless just with an 8% default.
And they knew it.
Of the enormous leverage that all of these people that had their hands in the pie were getting.
They knew it.
That's what made it so absurd.
They knew it.
And they knew it.
They knew
it was going to crash.
Well, how inaccurate is the description of you have a underlying base something, you know, I mean, you got a mortgage, you got something, you know, or an index or something. And then you have AIG coming out and saying, hey, we're selling insurance policies on this index. And you don't get to just sell one. You could sell unlimited amounts. You could sell, you know, 50, take 5 gazillion trillion bets on the outcome of a race. And you make the money on the transaction, but if it goes bad, there's no underlying. That's why they don't like it be called insurance, because insurance, you have to, by regulation or whatever, by law, you have to have the ability to pay it off. Well, they didn't even have the pretend that they were going to be able to pay it off, did they?
These people didn't even understand what they're doing. Now, Joe Cassano at AIG, he was one person that knew. But one reason why AIG entered the picture in the first place is that they weren't securities regulated. In other words, they were insuring securities, but they didn't have the SEC, not that it would have done any good, overseeing what they were doing. Because they were an insurance company, they didn't come under that umbrella, and they didn't come under under those regulations. And that's why AIG was just, and of course, they were reporting these premiums that they were getting as bottom line profits. They weren't reserving for it as they should have, and so forth. So to the guys that were running AIG, they didn't know what Cassano was doing, but they were reporting such massive profits, just like they were at Merrill and Goldman and all these other people, and they didn't even know what they were doing. They didn't know what these bond traders were doing.
Did anybody?
That they were incurring.
Did anybody know what they were doing? Somebody did. Goldman's sitting there, you know,
well,
making
the guys,
sure
the guys in the front line. I mean, they knew. I'm sure that Hank Paulson knew what was going on at Goldman, but you know, who was the guy that got fired from Merrill Lynch? He had no idea what his bond department was doing that were making all these profits. He didn't even understand. I wrote about him. He was out playing golf 3 or 4 times a week. How in the hell could he be in touch with what was going on?
You know, there was one guy, Goldman Sachs, it was a few months ago, they offered up some 32-year-old VP of something. Oh, it was his fault. Remember that? You know, I can't remember who it was. I'm going, seriously, this is it? You know, hopefully he's got a nice little parachute.
There's always a scapegoat, so the guys at the top can escape, you know.
They had a trader
at Goldman, a young guy, 30-year-old guy, who received a $100 million bonus. $100 million bonus at the end of 2007. Because he was selling all of this junk to all the banks and all these pension funds around the world.
Okay, so we kind of got a bead on one. It was pretend money. It was paper. It was it's just, you want to know how your money becomes theirs? Well, if you really care, you can study all this. But the bottom line is this. social and economic engineering using law and the tax code to get you. And I'll give you another example. You want to know a new, big, giant, humongous bucket of money that they're going to make sure their only thing they're arguing about is where the plumbing is going to go to somebody's pocket is health care. It's just another line on your check. It's going to go into a new bucket of money, and they're going to go, oh, and that's ours now, too. And this is going to continue to happen until, as a people, we have a culture that understands the fundamentals of economics and that the biggest problem is a guy with a gun put into your head saying, you by force have to give us your money, or we're going to use incentives and so on and tax breaks and this to make you put it over in this bucket, name it pension fund or whatever, so that we have it in one place so we can go get it later. Thank you very much. And all we got to do, there's always some guy that's got to sign a piece of paper. It comes down to one guy. It's a fund manager or something like that. And all he needs is green fees and hookers, and we're going to get him to sign the paper. Okay, so this is what happened. We got to stop. And the only way that we can do this is kind of this agorism kind of thing. We just, you know, we'll just do it ourselves. We're buying junk silver. We're paying, you know, with, 90% dimes for our loaves of bread or whatever. Because if we don't get out of this system, you will never survive it. It's not meant for you to survive. It's meant for you to be a cog in the machine to give your money to them. And who are them? They, them, those. Let me tell you, they, them, those are. There are those that just want to be left alone, and there are those that just won't leave us alone, and they got shiny badges and guns, and they're taking our money. I give you an opportunity to comment on my rant.
I think it was very good. I enjoyed it. But it's all coming to an end. It has to come to an end. It's unsustainable, and of course the complexity right now, as you allude to, is that the administration, the government that we're dealing with now, the heavy-handedness, and that they're coming in desperation after us, our money with cap and trade taxes and with the Obamacare taxes and everything else. That's why there's going to be a revolt. I mean, people are going to wake up and they're going to say, "I've had enough, and I'm not gonna take it anymore."
Yeah, we got Gerald Celente coming on.
That's where we're headed, and that's where the end game is.
We got Gerald Celente coming on next week, man. I know what he's gonna say. Revolution, man, revolution. You know, the one thing, here's another 100-pound rock they're putting in my granddaughter, 1-year-old backpack. Okay, here it comes. You ready? Here comes cap and trade. And they're gonna use the definite, first it's global warming, and that's not panning out. So they're going, "Oh, you know what? Oh, man, we need to have a cap and trade tax on energy. That's a real good reason. We'll give you a good reason. It's called the oil cesspool in the Gulf of Mexico. That's a reason." Okay.
That's right. That's their tipping point. Yep.
Oh, no. I can see it coming. They had this bioremediation. You know, I remember we did stories on this, and I'm going, I remember they had an oil spill in Texas, was it 15 years ago or something? And they cleaned it up with bacteria that eats the oil, and they will not do it. It won't I'm like, what the heck is going on?
They want to prolong it and make it worse.
Why?
Don't let a crisis go to waste.
Oh, see, you're my favorite. Okay, and that's exactly how I see it. They're going, don't you get it? They need it to be global. They want tar balls washing up on the coast of France. You know, this is going to be huge. They will not let this go to waste. And I guarantee you, we're going to be hearing about cap and trade because we love Mama Earth. And, I'm going.
That's coming real quick.
Yep. We haven't even heard anything about it. I'm wondering why. They haven't made the transition.
They tried to ram it through the Environmental Protection Agency, and they got some obscure methodology. They got it. The Republicans got it defeated. But they were going to bring that. They were going to exercise and get cap and trade initiated through the Environmental Protection Agency, and not even go through Congress. It is just absolutely unbelievable what these guys are trying to do.
The end is nigh! The end is nigh. How are we going to say? Well, that's what we're going to do in the final segment when we come back with Mr. Quist. This has been great. And I'm going to give you, start thinking about it, and when we come back, we need to what? We need to, I just want to keep breathing in and out, and maybe there's a upside at the end. We're one day closer to freedom after it falls down.
Freedom's the answer. What's the question? You're listening to Ernest Hancock.
Something you can do about it. You can understand it. You can ride it. You can survive it. We need to survive it. Got chickens in your backyard. That's what we need. I'm telling you, man, this is going to get bad. I cannot paint a picture bad enough. It's not even going to, it's going to be the greatest depression. I saw this in the summer of 08 or 07. I wrote an article, and I was going on, when I first found out about the Bank of International Settlements, and there was a little rumor going out that they go, oh, no, you can't audit the Federal Reserve, we'll audit them. I'm like, who the heck are you guys? You're going to be auditing the Federal Reserve? Where does that come from? Then you start finding out there that, all the money's funneling. Where's it going? Is it going to go to some central plan de la, some other buddy's bucket? And, and of course, Goldman Sachs will get their cut. So I'm just going, this is going to go. And I want H.L. Quist to have the opportunity before we get to the end here and tell us what we got to do, man, to help us. Help. I don't want to die. What are we going to do?
Well, obviously be debt free is the ultimate. And I realize a lot of our listeners not going to be able to do that, but right now I've advised people to be in gold and bonds. The U.S. Treasury bond short term is the safe haven for the short term. But I've also talked about other currencies and being in probably the Canadian dollar, the Swiss franc is the best currencies to be in now. But there is a way to protect yourself because when this whole thing implodes, what I told the class on Tuesday is that cash will be king again. When all this debt is just washed away, it's just like in the Depression. If you had $1,000 or $10,000 in 1935, you were a rich person. And that's when all this debt is just, there's trillions of debt that's never going to be repaid, from credit card debt to homeowners, mortgages and so forth will never be repaid.
Well, a lot of people
pensions are going to be compromised. Social Security is going to be compromised. That's what's ahead.
Okay,
after the hyperinflationary boom.
Okay, so you're looking at people that have lots of debt. I mean, credit cards, their mortgage, they're upside down in all this, and they just say, you know what? Let me tell you how I get rid of my debt. I walk away from it.
And that's what they're doing. That's what they're doing now.
Well, they're getting debt free. That's one way to get debt free is just say, I ain't paying it no more.
That's what's going to happen.
So, and then what? I mean, if we're going to try and have a sustainable society, a culture, even have America even maintain any kind of semblance of a border, or you have the state starting to do secession, I mean, how as human beings living in this geographical area in North America, are we going to reconstitute something? Are we going to try and just, are we going to go, hey, how about no government? Or are we going to have a different one? We're going to go back to the States. I mean, you got a minute, man. Just, give me what you think's going to happen.
Well, I think from a financial standpoint, one thing is that we're headed for the world currency. They're going to wrap all this debt up and create the woku. That's the short name for world currency is woku. We thought we would have the North American Union. I think we're going to bypass that. They're going to wrap all of Europe and the U.S. together, and we're going to have a one world currency.
Yeah, no, I've been saying that for a long time. Amero, are you kidding me? They're going to go straight to the world-o.
The world-o.
The dodo. So this is, I tell you what, the world currency is going to wind up being, for those that know better, it's going to be silver and gold. That's what it's going to be, So we'll see how it works out. Hey, thanks for coming on. I really enjoyed it, and I want to make sure
Thank you, Ernest, and I hope that people, my contact will be listed on your website, I assume.
Oh, it's already up there. Top on there. We're gonna talk to you some more. You expect a call. We're going to be
gonna
be friends.
I'm out in the hinterlands in New Mexico. I'm near the border right now on our ranch in New Mexico.